exploration. I will present you two examples of these technologies that are used by only one or two countries in the world. The process of discovering an oil field has many stages, such as geological, geochemical, seismography, geometry, magnetometry, on-ground seismography, identification of the size and structure of the reservoir, and only after this stage, the well is drilled, which of course is not referred to as an oil field yet, but a prospect. One of the current technologies in the world is the use of airplanes to measure the magnetic waves up to the 7 or 8,000 meters below the surface of the Earth. The type of the aircraft used must be very light. The onboard navigation equipment, as well as the equipment we need for aerial magnetometry, these should not interfere with each other. The length of the wings of the aircraft must be changed. This means that both the inside of the plane, that is the navigation equipment, and the appearance of the plane must undergo many changes. Until 2 years ago, we did not have the knowledge of this technology. But an Iranian company, with the support of the current administration, was able to build this plane. In addition to all these complicated details, there must be no noise inside the plane. Even the air conditioning inside the plane should be turned off, because the waves that are sent to nearly 8,000 meters below the surface of the Earth, the smallest noise can affect the reflection of these waves, and the results will not be accurate enough. Currently, this aircraft is built and used in Iran, and we have been able to collect data from a depth of 8,000 meters for an area of almost 65,000 kilometers. Another issue is the pilots who have the ability to fly these planes. These pilots are few in the world. Why? Because firstly, this plane must be very light. Secondly, they must fly at a height of 350 to 400 meters above the ground. And thirdly, when this plane is moving on a flat surface and suddenly a hill comes across or a mountain, the pilot, while moving up the plane, is not allowed to surpass 5 degrees angle because the distance of the plane from the ground should not change. In the second project, we have and we are cooperating with another knowledge-based company in order to shorten the exploration period because it usually takes 7 years. We have to use modern technology, and sometimes we have to apply special engineering designs to reduce the period from 7 years to 5 years. Based on a new method in the world called the surface geochemical method, which requires its own devices and equipment, the existence of a gas field can be detected through a bacterium. There is a special type of bacteria that feeds on butane gas. The knowledge-based company that helps us in this field has been able to identify this bacterium on the surface of the earth in some parts of the country. First, the soil of the desired area is sampled to a depth of 5 to 10 centimeters and is transferred to the special laboratories for this work. We extract the RNA of this bacterium and determine what kind of gas it has consumed. If it consumes butane gas, we realize that there must be a source of butane gas or propane under the place where this bacteria lives. And by the grace of God, we have been successful in testing this method in two regions of the country where we already knew have oil and gas fields. We carried out this method, and the test results confirmed that there is oil or gas in that area. We are testing different areas with different specifications. In fact, doing a long geochemical process or doing a seismography in an area where we don't know what is underground will impose high costs. But with this method, we know very well that there is oil or gas reservoirs underneath. I mean, we don't need to seismograph tens of kilometers anymore. We only seismograph the area where the bacteria were found. Therefore, both time and money are saved.
How would we compare Iran with its neighboring countries? Because they too are major producers of oil and gas in the world and have good resources. What superiority does Iran have over them in the field of oil exploration? And what position does Iran hold in terms of oil and gas resources?
There is a major difference between Iran's oil industry and the oil industry of our neighboring countries, or the Persian Gulf region and Eurasia. The difference is that Iran completely relies on domestic knowledge, Iranian technology, Iranian knowledge, Iranian experts. This means that oil exploration is indigenized in Iran, and we do not need to ask for help from outside the country. I dare say that in our neighboring countries, the knowledge of exploration is not native at all. Foreign companies work for them, and local forces themselves do not participate in exploration. This achievement has made us progress in the region because sanctions are no longer effective in this area. We don't even need to bypass the sanctions in this regard. Another important point is that the position of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the region is different. You see, Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves combined, and we are the second largest in terms of gas reservoirs. We were once very dependent on oil. Today, we have moved towards gas. You will not find a gallon of oil in any house in Iran anymore. The infrastructure of the country's facilities is also based on gas energy. After the Islamic Revolution, the gas industry flourished in the country and was indigenized. This is not the case in the countries of the region. In gas fields, except for the South Pars field, which we share with Qatar, no other country in the region, from Saudi Arabia to the UAE or Iraq and Oman, none of them have as much gas as Iran. We are the first in the region to develop independent gas fields that only have gas. OPEC statistics, the statistics officially announced by OPEC, prove this claim. When we look at the dimensions of the proven oil reserves of the countries in the region, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iraq, Kuwait, and Qatar, we notice something very important. Look at Saudi Arabia. Its proven oil reserves is almost finished. That is, it no longer has new exploration reserves to offer. I mean, in OPEC, you see its numbers do not change anymore, but Iran's reserves are increasing every year. This shows that Iran's capacity in the area of oil field exploration is unending. This is not my claim. OPEC statistics prove it. Among the few countries I mentioned, we had the largest increase in oil reserves. The rest of the countries had very little growth. This is the result of Iran's discovered reserves that we declare to OPEC, and then it is officially registered there under the name of Iran.
Considering the undiscovered oil and gas fields and the significant oil sediment residues that exist in Iran, as a final question, let's take a look at the future. What is Iran's position regarding the importance of energy stability?
We have 200 sedimentary basins in the world. As you know, in the past, Iran's landmass was mostly covered by sea. By sedimentary basins, I mean that millions of years ago, sedimentations were made and gas and oil molecules were formed in these basins. In fact, oil extraction is through these basins. We're dealing with the layers of earth in which oil and gas is trapped and needs to be extracted. 200 sedimentary basins have been identified in the world, of which 20 are very loaded and rich. They are superior in the sense that the hydrocarbon capacity inside them is very high, like the South Pars gas field. Based on the numerous studies conducted, speaking of these 20 fields, Iran ranks fourth in terms of capacity. Well, this shows the position of Iran in the future. Iran plays a key role in energy stability. Another point is that according to the U.S. Geological Survey, which publishes its analysis of the world's energy resources every year, it is stated that in the end, if all the countries in the world run out of oil and gas, there will be three countries left which will continue to explore oil and gas. Note, no production, but discovery. Iran is one of those three countries. Another point related to sedimentary basins is that out of these 200 sedimentary basins that I mentioned, there are 9 sedimentary basins only in Iran. Iraq has only one sedimentary basin. So does Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. But Iran has 9 sedimentary basins. It means that the ability of discoveries in Iran is 9 times more than others. It is interesting to know that out of these 9 sedimentary basins, 3 basins have a very high potential in the world, one of which is the Zagros Mountains on the Iranian side. South of the Zagros Mountains, where there are many fields in Khuzestan or Ilam, is one of the largest sedimentary basins in the world. These show that Iran has been insured in terms of energy in the world for decades and can be the world's energy supplier. Therefore, if a country signs agreements with Iran to supply its needed energy, it'll be relieved that it will not face problems in the future.
Thank you once again, sir, for being on the show. And I hope you enjoyed this edition of Face to Face. Take care.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Inflation has been a big reason why millions of Americans have expressed a gloomy outlook about the U.S. economy. Even though officials have claimed that unemployment rate in the United States is at a half-century low of 3.4%, and many workers have received pay gains. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. A key index of United States prices ticked higher in April and consumer spending rebounded, a sign that inflationary pressures in the economy remain high. The index, which is called Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index and is closely monitored by the U.S. Federal Reserve, showed that prices rose 0.4% from March to April. That was much higher than the 0.1% rise the previous month. Measured year over year, prices increased 4.4% in April, up from 4.2% in March. The year over year figure is down sharply from a 7% peak last June, but remains far above the U.S. Federal Reserve's 2% target. Friday, 26th of May's report from the government claimed that despite rising prices, consumers remain buoyant. The spending jumped 0.8% from March to April, the biggest increase since January. Much of the increase was driven by spending on new cars, which soared 6.2%. At the same time, the persistence of high inflation rate is complicating the U.S. Federal Reserve's interest rate decisions. The chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, has signaled that the Fed will likely forego a rate hike when it meets in mid-June, after 10 straight increases in the past 14 months. But a vocal group among the Fed's 18-member Interest Rate Setting Committee has pushed for more interest rate hikes later this year on the grounds that inflation isn't slowing quickly enough. Michael Gapon, U.S. economist at Bank of America Securities, said inflation is too sticky for the Federal Reserve to commit to an extended pause. Even if the Fed skips June, it will keep July in play for a rate hike. U.S. Federal Reserve officials particularly watch a category of prices called core inflation, which includes volatile energy and food costs and is considered a better gauge of underlying inflation. Core prices rose 0.4% from March to April, the same as in the previous month, and 4.7% from 12 months earlier. The year-over-year core inflation figure has changed little since it first touched 4.6% in December. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index is separate from the government's better-known Consumer Price Index, the CPI. The government reported earlier this month that the CPI rose 4.9% in April compared with 12 months earlier. Since inflation began surging after the pandemic recession, the PCE index has tended to show lower inflation than the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. In part, that was because rents, which were among the biggest inflation drivers, carry twice the weight in the CPI that they do in the CPE. In addition, the CPE index seeks to account for changes in how people shop when inflation jumps. As a result, it can capture emerging trends when, for example, consumers shift away from pricey national brands in favor of cheaper store brands. The latest inflation figures arrived as U.S. Federal Reserve officials are noisily debating their next step and having raised their key interest rate 10 times in the past 14 months. Several of the policymakers have said they favor raising interest rates even higher in the coming months. But most Fed watchers expect the central bank to forgo another interest rate hike at its next meeting in mid-June. Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, said recently that after raising the benchmark rate to a 16-year high of about 5.1%, Fed officials can afford to wait and see how those increases have affected the economy. It can take a year or even more for interest rate hikes to significantly slow the job market and the overall economy. The U.S. Federal Reserve's ultimate goal is to make borrowing costlier for consumers and businesses and thereby reduce spending, growth, and inflation. Its interest rate increases have led to a more than doubling of mortgage rates and elevated the cost of car loans, credit card borrowing, and business loans. They have also heightened the risk of a recession, which most economists predict will begin sometime this year. Even some officials who likely favor skipping an interest rate hike in June, like Philip Jefferson, a member of the Fed's influential Board of Governors, have said they are disappointed that inflation has not slowed more than it has. Much of the latest inflation pressure reflected persistently high prices for services, including meals in restaurants, hotel rooms, and car maintenance. Inflation has been a big reason why millions of Americans have expressed a gloomy outlook about the U.S. economy, even though the unemployment rate is at a half-century low of 3.4%, and many workers have received pay gains. Yet a recent U.S. Federal Reserve report found that, on average, inflation has outstripped those wage increases and left many people worse off. At the end of last year, just below three-quarters of the American public said they were doing okay financially or living comfortably. That marked a drop of 5 percentage points from the previous year and was among the lowest such levels measured since the survey began back in 2016. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story. Large US companies are taking shelter in bankruptcy court, a sign of a tightening credit squeeze as interest rates rise and financial markets become less hospitable to borrowers. Eight companies with more than $500 million in liabilities have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy this month, including five in a single 24-hour stretch last week. In 2022, the monthly average was just over three filings. According to figures compiled by bankruptcydata.com website, 27 large debtors have filed for bankruptcy so far in 2023, compared to 40 for all of 2022. Among recent companies to succumb to creditors include Envision Healthcare, Vice Media, and Kid Fenwall, a maker of fire control systems facing thousands of lawsuits over its use of so-called forever chemicals. The bankruptcies come after years of quiescent markets and rising valuations allowed even financially stressed firms to raise debt and equity capital to stay afloat. Debt default rates had fallen to about 1% in 2021 as central banks pumped money into the coronavirus pandemic-stressed economy. Now, the Standard & Poor's Global forecast that the 12-month trailing default rate for speculative-grade securities will jump from the current 2.5% to 4.5% by early 2024. Yields on junk bonds have more than doubled from less than 4% in mid-2021, as measured by the BA US High Yield Index, an indication of how much more expensive capital has become for less creditworthy borrowers. The US Federal Reserve has warned that lenders could further contract the supply of credit to businesses after recent turmoil in the banking sector. Bill Darrow, investment banker at Moelis, who advises clients across distressed situations, said, "Our general view is that we're going to see an increase in hard restructuring, driven by a combination of higher debt levels from the borrowing binge of COVID and rising interest rates. The triggerers will be running out of money and inability to refinance maturing debt." He added, "Some companies have used every trick in the book and now have run out of tricks."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Hannibal Directive, that's the name for one of the most dramatic and controversial mercury procedures in the history of the Israeli military. In terms of what it signifies, it's an order that mandates the Israeli army to kill its own troops rather than allowing them to be taken as captives. The order was drafted in mid-1986, just months after the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon. It clearly stated that in case of capture, the main mission becomes rescuing soldiers from the captors at the cost of hitting or wounding the soldiers. Now, nearly four decades after, the measure is becoming challenging for Tel Aviv to conceal its combat-related deaths. According to an article published by online news magazine The Cradle, during the recent five-day Israeli aggression on Gaza, there was renewed controversy over the regime's refusal to acknowledge its human losses in military conflicts with Palestinian resistance forces. The Cradle says Palestinian fighters launched over 1,500 missiles targeting approximately 80 cities and towns. Some of the missiles struck crowded neighborhoods in Ashkelon, Tel Aviv, Ramla, causing significant destruction. Although reports circulated about dozens of deaths and injuries, with eyewitnesses describing scenes of utter devastation, the only published image was the one showing a deceased individual in a settlement near Tel Aviv. Later, Israeli officials admitted the killing of a Jewish settler and a foreign worker, while claiming 74 others were wounded. 1 month prior to the Israeli-Gaza onslaught, Palestinian and Israeli media reported Israel's admission of four officers having been killed in a 2014 operation carried out by Hamas military arm, the Al-Aqsa Brigades. During the operation, the Qassam fighters infiltrated a site near an Israeli settlement in northern Gaza Strip through a 3-kilometer tunnel. Israeli officials initially claimed that the soldiers had neutralized all 12 attackers and did not disclose any casualties among its own ranks. The Israeli regime has a long history of refusing to acknowledge its human losses from Palestinian resistance operations, particularly among its own military personnel. For decades, the regime has been promoting the notion to its adversaries that its soldiers do not die in warfare. But facts on the ground prove otherwise. In November 1982, Palestinian resistance fighter Ahmad Qasir carried out an operation at an Israeli military headquarters in southern Lebanon. Up until today, the regime has refused to admit that the bombing claimed the lives of 141 of its soldiers. Now, decades after the incident, the regime still falsely attributes the explosion to a gas leak or a structural error that led to the building collapse and refuses to acknowledge that despite convincing evidence, it was in fact a suicide bombing that caused the explosion. Ever since that bombing, numerous incidents have happened with Israeli officials maintaining the policy of refusal and misinformation regarding its troop losses. In May 2022, a former Israeli minister disclosed that Officer Barak Sharabi from the Sayeret Matkal unit was killed in an operation in Syria in 1984, contrary to claims by authorities that he died in a car accident. Another one in the year 2021, when Israeli archive disclosure revealed the actual death toll from 1991 Iraqi missile strike on Israel were almost 5 times the officially stated number. Providing such misinformation has even drawn reaction from international rights bodies, with some of them saying official Israeli statistics should be treated with caution. All what it is the fact that the regime in Tel Aviv is very sensitive to acknowledging human losses, so it established a highly disciplined media system completely subject to the army's narrative. Israeli soldiers are said to get used to hearing the phrase, "He completed the mission and returned home safely," a behavior which has become the subject of ridicule for new armed resistance groups, namely the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade. They said let the Israeli regime announce its deaths in road accidents, falling from trees and adventures alike. What one would easily differentiate, though, is the cause each side is fighting for. One for the liberation of their land, and the other for occupying the land of others.
It's a moment that will surely be marked in history books. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad being welcomed back to the Arab League after an 11-year absence, an absence that was forced on it due to the war in Syria by Daesh terrorists, were supported by some of the very same countries present at the summit. Now times have changed, and all countries in the region have normalized ties with Syria. The U.S. support for Daesh terrorists was not so much a quest for democracy for Syrians, as the U.S. stated, but more of an obsession to oust the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. So for U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the rest of the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf, even Jordan, to embrace the Syrian president is surely a slap in the face of the U.S. Just like how Iran and Saudi Arabia reconciled after years of hostility, another colossal event which, according to the CIA director, the U.S. was blindsided by this major development. U.S. blindsided by Iran-Saudi rapprochement surely puts into question the weak level of U.S. intel on the ground in West Asia, but not accepting these realities just makes the U.S. isolated and detached from reality. As such, the U.S. is reacting, and true to U.S. behavior, it is doing so against international law. It has been reported that the U.S. has started to build a new military base in the northern province of Raqqa. When it comes to the U.S. illegal occupation of Syria, there are currently at least 24 U.S.-led coalition military sites spread throughout Syria's northeast. The largest base housing U.S. troops is the Al-Omar Field. The oil field in Deir al-Zour province is Syria's largest and has a presence of U.S. personnel and the YPG-PKK terrorist group. Then there is the Al-Tanf, also known as the Al-Tanf Garrison. It is a U.S. military base, but the territory is controlled by the so-called Syrian opposition in Homs governorate. Overall, the U.S. is occupying roughly a third, or 33% of Syrian territory. What are U.S.'s main goals in Syria? Brett McGurk, the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa, said the U.S. had four main objectives in Syria: to reduce violence, maintain military pressure on Daesh, address Syria's humanitarian crisis, and to support Israel. Except for the last goal, the U.S. has not achieved any of those stated aims. The U.S. stated goal of eradicating Daesh terrorists rings hollow. For starters, how could the U.S. not eliminate about 1,000 Daesh terrorists since the year 2016, when they first occupied Syrian soil? That is because they are using these terrorists against the Assad government, with the outdated notion of regime change. There are also reports that the U.S. trains these terrorists to use them in places like Afghanistan or other countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. is also stealing Syrian oil and selling it in the black market to provide finances for the YPG Kurdish forces and also for forces inside Iraq, since, in terms of the YPG Kurdish forces, they had supported them with the promise of partitioning an area for them in northern Syria. But the real purpose of the U.S. presence in Syria, as it has stated, to support Israel with the aim of targeting Iran, who is in Syria with the consent of the Syrian government. Both the U.S. and Israel need a wake-up call. The geopolitical shifts in the region have proven one thing: there is no need for the U.S. presence there. All countries have normalized with each other, except for maybe Yemen and Saudi Arabia, who are on course to do so. And when it comes to the security of the region, after Iran and Saudi Arabia's normalization, there is a united front that has been formed, where regional countries have stated that they will ensure their own security. There may have been a time when countries like Saudi Arabia may have sought U.S. assistance and even paid them to provide it with their security, which also included weapon sales, but those days are over. Also gone are the days when the U.S. created Iranophobia to scare regional countries into buying U.S. weapons, with the false notion that Iran was a bad actor. West Asian countries have realized that it is the U.S. and Israel who are now the bad actors in the region. This warning to the U.S. military by the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Navy, perhaps states it best. But he said, "You are damn wrong to be in our region." A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. The countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK special forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, The numbers from the U.S. and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the, I think it's the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict a lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly now, the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq. And obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And I say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the US state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates, and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson's visit to the U.S. comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the U.S. and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
иначе бы НАТО не поставляло такого.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario. And the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Лежать на Североатлантическом альянсе.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgorod region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western Military District units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The UK media decry draconian fees for Conservative Party conference coverage. Registering for the event this autumn will cost journalists £137 until July 1st and £880 afterwards. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the decision by the ruling Conservative Party to charge journalists attending its annual conference is undemocratic and should be abandoned, a coalition of British media organizations have said. A number of media outlets say the fees are draconian and have refused to sign up for the Tory event, which will take place in Manchester in October, the Evening Standard reported recently. The Conservative Party had already charged journalists to cover the conference last year, saying it was necessary to prevent people from signing up for accreditation and not attending. The party is sticking to the same rules this year. Journalists will have to pay 137
£1,000 until July 1st and £880 afterwards to register. The coalition of industry bodies, which includes groups as the News Media Association, Society of Editors, News Media Coalition, and Foreign Press Association, warns that the party of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is setting a deeply concerning precedent in a democratic society. The coalition said that its members are united in viewing as undemocratic and detrimental to the interests of society. And the party itself, the decision by the Tories to charge journalists to attend the conference. The statement read, "In a democratic society, all party conferences are of considerable political and public importance, and as such, there should be no charging barrier for journalists to be able to act as the eyes and ears of the public by freely reporting at such events." The annual Tory conference is more than just a local event. It also provides a window for the global community to see UK democracy in action, it added. The authors of the statement say they have been trying to reach out to the ruling party to discuss the issue of fees for more than a year now without results. Conservative Party spokesman told the Evening Standard that the modest charge was introduced to discourage over accreditation by some media outlets. He claimed that in previous years, thousands of accredited journalists failed to show up, which cost the party tens of thousands of pounds for police security checks and created a lot of paper and plastic waste. There are also exemptions for media outlets in complicated financial situations, he added. Meanwhile, RT reported Britain's Conservative Party lost more than 1,000 council seats in local elections recently, with the Labour Party and Liberal Democrats dividing the spoils. With 229 of the 230 councils reporting, Sunak's party had secured 2,299 of just over 8,000 seats, losing 1,058. The Labour Party took 2,674, a gain of 536, while the Liberal Democrats took 1,626, a gain of 405. Independent councillors secured 874 seats, a loss of 80, while the Greens took 481, doubling their presence on local authorities. According to reports, the Conservative Party has lost control of more than 40 councils, including Medway in southeast England, which it has run since late 1990s. Labour leader Keir Starmer celebrated his party's success in Medway, telling supporters that "we are on course for a Labour majority at the next general election." In the UK, local elections are often viewed as referendums on the party in power. The Tories have been in power since 2010, although the last year of Conservative rule has been a tumultuous one. Boris Johnson resigned as Prime Minister in disgrace amid the Partygate scandal last summer, only to be replaced by Liz Truss, who managed in her 6 weeks in office to crush the value of the British pound with a budget that included billions of pounds worth of tax cuts. Sunak, a former banker, was touted by the party as a steady hand who could restore economic stability. However, food and energy costs have continued to rise under his leadership, and the UK is said to have the worst performing large economy in the world this year, according to figures from the International Monetary Fund.
However, local elections are also decided on local issues such as parking fees and garbage collection. The Conservatives have lost 1,330 seats in 2019 local elections before winning a landslide majority in a general election less than 6 months later. Speaking to reporters recently, Sunak called the results disappointing, but said that he was not detecting any massive groundswell of movement toward the Labour Party or excitement for their agenda.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with Iranian commanders and senior military officials in the Imam Khomeini Hosseini on April 16, 2023. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the vestige of God remaining on earth. You are all very welcome here. As Major General Muhammad Baqiri said, I too am happy about this meeting, which is being held after a long break. I hope that, God willing, the Almighty God will grant you success in that which pleases him, and in that which is necessary for your great, important acts of service. I'd also like to congratulate you on the Iranian New Year. Although almost a month has passed now, since Nowruz, Eid Nowruz, can continue for 2 or 3 months, so it doesn't matter, you can still congratulate people. Mr. Bakri's statements were very good too. In other words, I have the same expectations of the armed forces as he spoke of. In addition, you planned and made decisions in certain places, which is very good. But making decisions is just half the work.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The other half is to take action. Follow things up and matters of that sort. Don't let your decisions get old. Don't allow them to remain untouched, become stale, and gradually forgotten. And don't be alarmed about me giving this advice, because this frequently happens. It happens both within and outside the armed forces. Decisions are made, and those who make decisions at the top of the organizational hierarchy are determined and serious people. They truly believe in their decisions, and they want them to be carried out. But when these decisions reach the tips of the organization, where there are different officials and human resources working at different levels, the decisions become fainter and sometimes they aren't carried out at all. Don't let this happen. This is one point. The second point is that you must follow up on the things you have started. now suppose, for example, that you start building a certain number of houses. Very well, but one of the problems with the plans for construction in our country is that it often takes longer than the required assigned time.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for three quarters of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. Yeah, people are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all forms of ethnic cleansing and colonialism. The Palestinian political prisoners also.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts, I think there should be sanctions, I think there should be punishments.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes, we feel. And we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been the only aggressor, end of story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time. Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Chaque samedi, bientôt cinq ans.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the yellow vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find